Welcome to the reading of the Des Moines Register for Sunday, June 28th, 2020. I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi. Things are changing very quickly, and IRIS wants to make sure we provide our listeners with as much local information as we can. In order to do that, we've changed our program schedule completely. This schedule will air statewide on all platforms until further notice. We will also include information about resources in your community during each paper. You'll still hear your Des Moines Register each day at 9 a.m., 6 p.m., and 1 a.m. Please listen closely to the following changes for all other newspapers. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m., Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m., Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. Recordings of all newspapers will be available on our podcast page. Just go to iowaradioreading.org, click Listen Now, then click Listen to IRIS Podcasts. The papers are organized by region. Each paper will be available for 7 days. Keep yourself safe, and thank you for listening. In today's weather, Council Bluffs has a likelihood of showers and thunderstorms before noon and then again after 5 p.m. Some storms could be severe. This is in Council Bluffs. The high in Council Bluffs area will be near 93, but new rainfall amounts of less than a tenth of an inch, except higher amounts possible during storms. Tonight in Council Bluffs will be about a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly before 10 p.m., with a low around 74. Des Moines and the Cedar Rapids area both have a chance of thunderstorms today, with a high near 90. Tonight, in both the Des Moines and Cedar Rapids areas, there's a chance of showers and thunderstorms. In Des Moines, mainly after 1 a.m., and in the Cedar Rapids area, mainly after 8 p.m. Lows tonight around Des Moines will be 74 and around Cedar Rapids, 71. Today's top front page story on the Des Moines Sunday Register is written by Courtney Crowder, and it focuses on the class of 2020, titled Radiating Resilience. Iowa's high school grads lose traditions to pandemic, but they see it differently. After spending most of her life near the banks of the Missouri River in Glenwood, Iowa, Jada Wilson was ready to experience her college years near a slightly bigger body of water, the Pacific Ocean. Wilson was heading west to the University of California at Berkeley, until she wasn't. Like many high school students in the class of 2020, Wilson's plans, immediate and long-term, were interrupted by the coronavirus pandemic. She didn't get a senior prom, a proper graduation ceremony, or to run at the state track meet. And now she was staring down the possibility of all online classes next year, an entirely different college experience, but with a price tag that most likely would be the same, she realized. Quote, "My mom, my grandparents, and my sister and I sat down and talked about it, and with all the uncertainty, we didn't know if it was quite worth the tuition," she said. Quote, "Not to mention issues with germ control and traveling and living in a new place. So I made the decision to stay close to home," end quote. She turned down Cal's offer and enrolled at Creighton University, an Omaha private school 25 miles from her home. Quote, "It feels like everything is changing, and the future I once saw so clearly isn't as clear anymore," she said. "But I guess that's just part of our new normal," end quote. The class of 2020 has lived so much of their lives in social upheaval that the fact their senior year has been waylaid by a global pandemic, the likes of which we've not seen in 100 years, is an almost cosmic twist of fate. These seniors were born in the weeks and months after 9/11, meaning America has been in a war their entire lives. Some watched families weather financial hardships during the Great Recession, and others feel a similar strain now as COVID-19 changes the face of work. For them, school shooter drills were as ordinary as those for fires or tornadoes. Technological advancements meant the world was connected, but with those improvements came a rise in bullying and in polarization, bringing the differences between red and blue into political technicolor. Police brutality, all forms of brutality, were caught on camera in an increasingly shareable format. In fact, everything was shared. Stack their lives up, tragedy by tragedy, and it's easy to define the class of 2020 by dread, expecting the future to feel like one step forward, two steps back. But that's too easy, they tell me. Too simple. Quote, I think the class of 2020 will be remembered in history books, not just because of how they were affected by this pandemic, but how they responded to it, the sacrifices that so many students made, and the grace with which they did that, said Fez Zafar, a Roosevelt High School graduate off to Harvard University in the fall. To define them in terms of dread only focuses on the problems they faced, not the solutions they created, he said. It lets the moments in time define them instead of how they defined the moment in time. And this non-graduation, that's just one small chapter in their lives, Zafar said. The real narrative of the class of 2020 will be how they changed this world, and that story has barely begun to be written. When the year changed. On prom night this spring, Lillian Grouse got all dressed up, but legitimately had nowhere to go. The Decorah High School senior and her closest friends donned their gowns for some socially distanced photos, had a potluck meal, pasta, caprese salad, and angel food cake, and pulled up chairs for an outdoor screening of the 1980s Goldie Hawn Kurt Russell classic, Overboard. It certainly wasn't the prom they'd imagined, Grouse tells me, with a small sigh, but there was a lot about this year they never envisioned. In the American zeitgeist, senior year of high school is both the last gasp of childhood and the first crack at adulthood. It's a time when students can strike out on their own with big decisions while having the safety nets of parents, teachers, and communities who are invested in their graduates. Senior year is also filled with rites of passage that pop culture has etched into our minds as the best moments of our lives. For Blake Vanderkamp, a Prairie City Monroe Mustang headed to Iowa State University in the fall, his final year started with, quote, overwhelming happiness, end quote. Quote, I have always been one of those people that says, this is going to be my year, and a lot of it was really great, he said. A lot of things I hoped for still happened, and even though they weren't the way I pictured them, it wasn't a letdown, end quote. For most of his high school career, Vanderkamp was locked in a battle for valedictorian with one of his classmates. This spring, PCM High announced the least exciting ending to this epic years-long race to the highest GPA. There would be two valedictorians. It's not the ending either of them wanted, but it is, quote, ironic, Vanderkamp said, maybe even the, quote, appropriate, subtle ending that this time calls for, end quote. Quote, it fits with this age where nothing is normal, he said. 9/11 happened when we were just born and were graduating in a worldwide pandemic, and now we have two valedictions at my high school for the first time ever, end quote. Quote, I'm desensitized to turmoil, he added. We were born in turmoil and grew up with it. It's part of the warped sense of how we view the world, end quote. Known as Generation Z, the kids graduating high school this year are defined by three major characteristics, said Ruth Eagelnick, a senior researcher at Pew Research Center. First, they are racially and ethnically diverse, particularly when compared to this country's older generations. Next, they are digital natives in the truest sense. While millennials came of age with the internet, Generation Z was born into the era when smartphones and constant connectivity were part of everyday life. And finally, while millennials understood the world before and after 9/11, including how society changed, Generation Z has lived their entire lives post 9/11. Quote, in the past, when people come of age during these very tough times, we've seen it shape who they are and their austerity and things like that, Eagelnick said. To Meyer, the difficulties of their lives have, quote, created them to be realists. We don't shy away from problems or challenges or things that make us uncomfortable, she said. I'm very optimistic about this class going into college because we recognize the system has flaws in so many ways, but we're not disheartened by that. We are encouraged to change it, end quote. Because they've witnessed war, hardship, and polarization, Generation Z doesn't have the so-called false sense of security that previous generations did, Vanderkamp said. They know that despite best intentions, jobs, houses, and retirements are not promised. And this extreme clarity on the issues they face has allowed them to easily pick up the mantle of change. Quote, it's our calling, for lack of a better word, to solve these problems, he said. Quote, we are the game changers. Even though I don't expect us to end world hunger or end all world wars, we will take the steps to make lasting changes and make the world better, end quote. The highs and lows of their lives have given them the tools to get through anything, said Calvin Aberg, a Rice University student who just graduated from Forest City High. The tough circumstances they've survived were character builders, he said, preparing them to take on whatever the world throws at them next. Quote, we know our way through adversity, Aberg said. Having things happen early in our lives and being exposed to not the nicest sides of humanity have been learning experiences that led to the defining resiliency of our class, end quote. Life, Vanderkamp says, is a fortunate accident. You don't get to pick out how it all turns out. Quote, but the reality of that is often, at the end of the day, you are better for having had to struggle, he says. Being the change. Instead of a big graduation party, Wilson's family bought a cake and held a little celebration at home. Surrounded by family, she ate and reminisced about what led to this first major turning point in life. Although all the pomp and circumstance was gone, love shone brightly like an afternoon sun parting a morning of clouds. Quote, it's disappointing to not have a normal senior year, but in the grand scheme of life, they are just ceremonies, and it doesn't change the fact that I spent 4 years meeting friends and teachers who I will keep up with for the rest of my life, she said. Sure, the class of 2020 is missing out on some of the Sweet Valley High memories, but if you keep thinking about what you don't have, you'll never be able to see the joy of what you do, she said. While the data is still new, early Pew research shows Generation Z has had to deal with some of the pandemic's greatest fallout. More than 30% of Gen Z personally lost their jobs, Engelmick said, and some 70% had someone in their household lose a job or take a pay cut. For some seniors, this unexpected hardship has offered a chance to reimagine their futures. Before the pandemic, Aberg was analytical, focused almost solely on, quote, discovery and achievement, he said. But watching his community weather hardships has shifted his interests, pushing him down career paths more focused on helping others. Zafar has always been interested in public policy of some sort, but the coronavirus response showed that policy doesn't have to mean politics. Quote, seeing how many professions responded to the pandemic and how the healthcare industry really emerged as saviors, I've been thinking that if I wanted to make a difference, maybe that is something to explore, he said. This ability to shift and change and grow is at the true heart of her class, Wilson said. They are and will be nimble, people who see a crisis and run toward it instead of waiting for it to find them. Quote, this time is showing us who we are and what's important, and there's no way that can't play a huge role in what happens in the future, Wilson says. And I hope that what is remembered about this class is that even when faced with adversity, we still manage to come out stronger, end quote. So I ask her before we hang up, what do you hope the future holds? Quote, I mean, she says, straining her voice a bit, it sounds silly, but I'd like to be president one day. End quote. No, Jada, to this columnist, that doesn't sound silly at all. In the other frontline story, Kim Norville of the Register reports redlining still shapes Des Moines home values. Bobretta Bruton was about 8 years old when her family moved from downtown Des Moines to the east side, where she had to start in a new school and try to make new friends. Her family's move wasn't because they were upgrading their home or relocating to be closer to work. It was the late 1950s, and the city had purchased Bruton's grandmother's home, where she, her parents, and two of her siblings lived together, to demolish it and those of other black residents. The city had identified the neighborhood as so-called slums and cleared it and others as part of urban renewal, an attempt to rid Des Moines of what leaders said were eyesores in favor of Interstate Highway 235 and new development that they believed would increase property value and bring more tax revenue to the city's coffers. But the decline of those neighborhoods was not by accident. 20 years earlier, the federal government had created a program that promoted mortgage lending, but at the same time ordered banks not to make loans in neighborhoods it deemed risky, primarily areas with non-white, low-income residents, said Kendall Larson, director of research and planning for the Polk County Housing Trust Fund. The practice was known as redlining, and as a result, black residents and other people of color could not secure funding to fix up their homes, purchase new ones, or sell them, cutting them off from participation in America's most effective form of wealth building. By design, Bruton's childhood neighborhood had fallen into disrepair, making it an easy target for city leaders who wanted to remove it and others like it in the name of progress. Quote, "The city looked at it just like a rundown neighborhood, but that was home to us," said Bruton, now 71. "The house was warm. We were clean. We got good food. We went to church. We did all kinds of family things together. We always had what we needed," end quote. While homes in some of other redline neighborhoods were spared, deep scars from the government-sponsored program remain generations later. Though boundary lines have shifted over 8 decades, the majority of neighborhoods that were once redlined have median single-family home values lower than the median home value citywide, according to data from the Polk County Assessor's Office. In at least 3 neighborhoods, values are half the median. Also, a majority of Des Moines' formerly redlined neighborhoods still are home to primarily minority residents, according to the Polk County Housing Trust Fund, which is hosting an ongoing exhibit, Undesign the Red Line. Quote, "This legal segregation in the 1930s caused the city of Des Moines to be forever shaped by this embedded system, both socially and physically. It is very clear that a negative legacy has been left on Des Moines' landscape because of these policies," the exhibit's website says. The exhibit's goal is to educate Iowans about the persistent inequities redlining created in the hope that new policies and programs will be put into place to help lift up the affected neighborhoods and right the wrongs that so many black residents have faced since Des Moines' redline map was created in 1938. Quote, "We really need a full retelling of this history first, and we need to ask the question, how did we get here and what happened?" said Braden Crooks, co-founder of Designing the We, a national organization that helps create local redline exhibits, including Des Moines. Quote, "That's really a critical part of, because if you're not very intentionally undoing this history and undoing structural racism and inequality, you're most often repeating and reproducing those systems," end quote. What is redlining? In 1933, as part of the New Deal, the government created the Home Owners Loan Corporation, designed to help failing banks refinance home loans and get Americans back into homeownership after the Great Depression. The program created the 30-year federally backed mortgage, which is still the standard today. But the program also instituted the discriminatory practice known today as redlining, advising banks where and how they should lend money. It prioritized loans in neighborhoods where majority whites lived and prohibited them in areas where black people and other minorities, such as Eastern Europeans, Jews, Asians, and Italians lived, Larson said. Quote, "Congress essentially wanted to bake into these programs systemic ways to cut out people of color from benefiting from them," she said on a recent tour of the exhibit, which has gone virtual during the COVID-19 pandemic. The government created lending maps in 239 cities, including Council Bluffs, Des Moines, Davenport, Dubuque, Waterloo, and Sioux City, using a 4-color system that identified neighborhoods where banks should invest their money. The 4 colors, red, yellow, blue, and green, were assigned by looking at the neighborhood's socioeconomic class, racial and ethnic population, types of housing and materials. Also considered was whether those who lived there were homeowners or renters, the latter more likely to be people of color. Red was marked so-called hazardous, meaning there was a, quote, "fear of infiltration of hazardous populations," end quote, should those residents get home loans. Yellow was marked as, quote, definitely declining, end quote, consisting largely of Black Americans. Blue was marked as, quote, still desirable, end quote, neighborhoods that were primarily white. And green was marked as, quote, best, white-only neighborhoods. Banks completely cut off investment in red neighborhoods and were advised to be cautious in yellow areas. Homeowners could still qualify for loans, but they might not be on the bank's best terms. In Des Moines, 34% of neighborhoods, including downtown, in the East Village, and on the south, east, and north sides, were redlined, according to the government map, digitized by the University of Richmond's Mapping Inequality Project. 41% were yellow, or, quote, definitely declining, end quote. Chautauqua Park, though it was almost entirely surrounded by red neighborhoods, was labeled green because it had a racially restrictive covenant that allowed only white people to purchase homes in the neighborhood. Redlining eventually waned and was formally outlawed by the Fair Housing Act of 1968. But its impacts linger, Larson said. Quote, it's allowing Jim Crow-era segregation to be baked not only into our home ownership, but into the physical landscape of our cities and how they develop, she said. When you have certain areas of the city completely cut off from investment, then that means that the parts that are getting investment are going to improve more over time than the areas that are not. So this really impacts how our cities look over time and really how our cities look today, end quote. Demolishing Black redlined neighborhoods for new investment. This systemic disinvestment led to many other issues in Black communities, as outlined by the Undesigned the Red Line exhibit. Lower property values, unsafe living conditions, crime, reduced access to insurance and health care. In the late 1950s through the 1970s, Des Moines went through urban renewal, as in other cities in the country, where white leaders identified blighted neighborhoods they could demolish to make way for new investment, including the $60 million I-235 freeway. In Des Moines, that meant clearing out Black, redlined neighborhoods. About 1,300 families and businesses were displaced, including all but two buildings on Center Street, a predominantly Black-owned business district downtown between 10th and 14th Streets. Center Street was once a thriving area with barbershops, restaurants, grocery stores, pharmacies, hotels, and laundromats. It was also known for its jazz clubs, which brought nationally renowned artists to Des Moines. In its place was a grand plan for private investment that never really came to fruition, said Eric Burmeister, executive director of the Polk County Housing Trust Fund. There now, a huge surface parking lot that serves Iowa Methodist Medical Center, an outdated strip shopping center, and the Oak Ridge neighborhood, a worthy, affordable housing development, but not the high-priced, high-taxable property that the fathers of urban renewal envisioned, Burmeister said. While the city and the state paid for the properties they planned to clear, home and business owners rarely received fair market value. Displaced families were faced with purchasing smaller or less appealing homes, available to them only in limited areas, Burmeister said. Some neighborhoods would not sell to Black families, or owners overpriced their homes, knowing a person of color would be unable to buy, according to a Des Moines Register archives. A training manual prepared the National Association of Real Estate Brokers must be prepared by the National Association of Real Estate Brokers, used by real estate agents until 1968, said Black residents should not try to purchase in white neighborhoods. Quote, the colored people certainly have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but they must recognize the economic disturbance which their presence in a white neighborhood causes and forego their desire to split off from the established district where the rest of their race lives, quote, it said. A May 27, 1959 article in the Des Moines Register outlined Black families' struggles to find new, comparable housing. Lavonia Craddock was given $5,500 for her three-bedroom home on 24th Street, but ended up having to pay $9,500 for a two-bedroom home. Maud Pickett, who lived on 16th Street, was given $3,400. Quote, when I told people I was looking for a house which would cost what the Highway Commission paid me, they laughed at me. My home is a nice home, with apple trees and room enough on the grounds for another house to be built, she was quoted as saying in the Register. The same was true for Bruton's grandmother, Grace Jones, who purchased a much smaller home a few blocks away. The move also split up her family. Bruton's parents purchased their own home on the east side. Not only were they all relocated, the move changed Bruton's grandmother forever. The hardworking, graceful mother of six became depressed, never adjusting to her new surroundings. And during the move, to make matters worse, Jones dropped a pitcher on her foot, which had to be amputated. Quote, she was really sad. She didn't know anybody up there. She didn't want to be up there, Bruton said. The Polk County Housing Trust Fund argues that redlining and urban renewal led to more issues that still present themselves today. In what became known as white flight, white residents began leaving cities for the suburbs, which led to urban decay. Manufacturers and companies followed them as they left the urban core. Because of this so-called capital flight, cities began so-called planned shrinkage, cutting off investment from declining areas of the city, formerly redlined areas, including fire service, garbage pickup, policing, and water. According to the exhibit, those unsafe conditions led to heroin and crack epidemics and mass incarcerations of the war on drugs, and, most recently, predatory lending that contributed to the foreclosure crisis. The resulting inequities are frequently cited in the protests that have erupted after the deaths of Black people at the hands of police. What can be done now? Today, 74% of redlined neighborhoods nationally are low to moderate income, according to a 2018 study by the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. Nearly two-thirds are minority neighborhoods, it found. Conversely, 91% of the green neighborhoods remain middle to upper income today, with 85% of them still mainly white. That segregation largely exists in Des Moines, where redlined neighborhoods are still home primarily to minority populations. In those minority census tracts, the median home value is about half of the $140,600 median home value in Polk County, according to the 2017 One Economy, the State of Black Polk County report. Black residents in Polk County are still denied home loans 2.2 times more than the countywide average, according to the report. And Black Polk County residents represent just 2.6% of all homeowners countywide, though they make up 6% of the population. Sherman Hill is one exception to the rule, in large part due to targeted restoration and revival by white Iowans who liked the neighborhood's history, architecture, and proximity to downtown. Burmeister said, "The largely minority population that lived there during redlining and before urban renewal no longer call it home," he said. Quote, "We still have to deal with the pandemic of racism that still affects us today. That is the invisible virus, human-made, that has infected and poisoned all communities in America," said Joshua Barr, director of the city's Civil and Human Rights Commission. Quote, "Des Moines is not immune to the virus of racism, and we have to dismantle that," end quote. The city took one step forward last year when it prohibited housing discrimination against people receiving public assistance, Barr said. But there's more that can be done, including developing policies that require affordable housing with any new development, requiring landlords to take a fair housing training class to get a rental certificate from the city, banning slumlords, creating programs for affordable home ownership, banning the box on rental applications requiring disclosure of felony convictions, and creating certain so-called empowerment zones in which the city can make targeted investments in once redlined neighborhoods, he said. The city also should consider land banking, in which government agencies and nonprofit organizations work together to purchase and remodel vacant or tax-delinquent properties and create programs that lead to affordable home ownership, Burmeister said. Quote, "Once you strengthen housing, so many other issues take care of themselves," Barr said. Quote, "It's that simple, but the question is, do we have the will and courage to do those things that are right? Typically, when it comes to investing in those who have been historically denied or historically marginalized, we just want those issues to go away, and we want to push them to the side. But those issues come back one way or another," end quote. Local advocates agree that the first step is education. The Polk County Housing Trust Fund will conduct virtual tours of Undesign the Red Line on Wednesdays on its Facebook page. More information can be found on its website, undesigndsm.com. It hopes to continue the in-person exhibit at Franklin Junior High when COVID-19 concerns wane. Quote, Des Moines is going to have to own up to its history and its responsibility before we can have any serious discussions, Burmeister said. And that is what we're hoping, from a housing standpoint, happens through this particular exhibit, end quote. For Bruton, finally telling her family's story to people who will listen has been rewarding, building on her lifelong work in local nonprofit organizations, where she tries to, quote, bridge the gap, end quote, for disadvantaged Iowans like her and her grandmother. Quote, it's really fulfilling for me to be able to tell her story, because at the time it was happening to her, there was nobody to listen. It was just, you guys need to get out of the way. Get out of the way of progress, she said. Quote, I think she'd be really proud that I talked about her in such a reverent way, end quote. This story is accompanied by a photograph of the 1936 lending map for the city of Des Moines, which identified which neighborhoods should get home loans and which shouldn't. Those labeled red and yellow were predominantly black neighborhoods and were cut off from banks' investments. In the COVID-19 report for Iowa on Saturday, as of 10 a.m. Saturday, the state of Iowa was reporting 3 additional COVID-19 deaths and an additional 380 confirmed cases since the state's tally from 10 a.m. Friday. Total confirmed cases are 27,935. Total deaths, 704. Total recovered, 17,413. Total tested, 288,213. These data are from the Iowa Department of Public Health. In local news, Philip Jones of the Register reports, according to TSA, man had loaded gun at airport. A Dallas County man brought a loaded gun to Des Moines International Airport Thursday, Transportation Security Administration spokeswoman Lisa Farbstein said on Twitter. The man, a resident of Waukee, was stopped by TSA officials when they saw a .380 caliber handgun in his carry-on bag, according to a TSA news release. The gun was loaded with 7 bullets, including one in the chamber. Farbstein told the Des Moines Register there was no indication of criminal intent. Passengers must place unloaded firearms in a locked, hard-sided container in checked luggage only, according to TSA guidelines. Magazines, clips, bolts, and other firearm parts also may not be transported in carry-on luggage. Quote, the proper way to travel with a firearm is to make sure it is unloaded, packed in a hard-sided case with a lock on it, said John Bright, TSA's Federal Security Director for Iowa, in the news release. Quote, then the traveler needs to take the case to their airline check-in counter and declare that they want to fly with it, end quote. Civil penalties may be issued to travelers who have guns with them at checkpoints, the news release states. It's unknown at this time if a civil penalty was issued for the Dallas County man. In crime and courts news, Danielle Gare of the Register reports the 25th anniversary of Jody Huzentrout's disappearance. Police, family, ask public for help in solving case of missing Iowa TV anchor. The search for answers continues 25 years after a young KIMT TV anchor disappeared outside her Mason City apartment. Jody Huzentrout, a 27-year-old Minnesota native, didn't show up for her 6 a.m. broadcast June 27, 1995, and was never heard from again. Huzentrout has been kept in the public eye thanks to friends, families, and others interested in the cold case. 6 months after the disappearance, the Des Moines Register reported there were no solid suspects despite an extensive police search. Today, despite investigating several people of interest over the years, police still don't have a main suspect. Quote, the fear that Jody Huzentrout's abduction stirs is widely shared, a 1995 Des Moines Register article said. Quote, women's vulnerability to crime is well understood, though not talked about much. Perhaps it's a fact of life, however abhorred, and because it is usually harassment or robbery or rape, but not a disappearance into thin air, end quote. After years of false hope over potential suspects and discovered bodies, those who knew Jody Huzentrout stay hopeful that one day their questions will be answered. Who is Jody Huzentrout? Jody Huzentrout, who was 27 years old at the time of her disappearance, was a Minnesota native who graduated from St. Cloud State University. She was an avid skier and moved to Mason City to become the morning and noon anchor woman 2 years before her disappearance. The morning of her disappearance, Huizentrout answered a call from a KIMT-TV producer. She said she had overslept and was going to head into the office. The producer called again at 5 a.m. with no response before co-workers requested police to perform a welfare check at her apartment. Police believed she was grabbed as she tried to unlock her red Mazda Miata shortly after 4 a.m. A hairdryer, a red pair of shoes, and a bottle of hairspray were found next to her car at her apartment complex. A palm print was on the car, and police found signs of a struggle. Quote, "There's nothing I'd rather do in my life right now than bring closure to the family," Mason City Police Sergeant Frank Stearns told the Register in 2005. Quote, "You just can't let it go. It becomes a part of you," end quote. What happened after her disappearance? She was legally declared dead in 2001. No one has been charged in her death, though police and family have not given up. In the 2005 article, family speculated over what they think happened to Huizentrout. Her mother, Jane Huizentrout, said she thinks her daughter is at the bottom of a lake near her home. Her cousin, Mary Lee Moberg, said she thinks a man stalked Jody Huizentrout. Quote, "Nothing adds up," Moberg said, "besides something like a stalker, some twisted person mentally," end quote. CBS's 48 Hours featured the case in December 2018, revealing new details of the case and footage, including police interviews with John Vansice, a friend of Huizentrout, who was believed to be the last person to have seen her before she vanished. In March 2018, Mason City Police executed search warrants for cars belonging to Vansice. He is 20 years older than Huizentrout and may have had an infatuation with her. Jim Axelrod, who hosted 48 Hours, went to Vansice's Arizona home to get a comment about the case, but Vansice gruffly declined. Tony Jackson, who was serving prison time for a string of Minnesota rapes during the 1990s, was also featured during the special. He was living in Mason City when Huizentrout disappeared. Mason City Police said he was not a so-called viable suspect a few years after the disappearance. Jackson declined an interview with 48 Hours, but maintained his innocence through an email. He would not confirm or deny whether he was still a suspect. Family, friends, and others interested in the case have kept momentum alive for the past 25 years. 4 billboards with her face and the words, quote, "Somebody knows something. Is it you?" were erected around the Mason City area in 2018. FindJody.com regularly provides updates with several articles posted some months. Each year, as the case remains unsolved, tributes to the news anchor with a Minnesotan accent and a contagious smile are posted to the website. Through times of no leads and false hope, the search for Jody Huizentrout continues. Police are asking the public to come forward with information regarding Huizentrout's disappearance. Call the Mason City Police Department at 641-494-3564 or the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation at 515-725-6010 or by email dciinfo@dps.state.ia.us. North Iowa Crime Stoppers can be reached at 1-800-383-088 with rewards available. In other crime and courts news, Charles Flesher of the Register reports, Des Moines police investigate after body found along roadside southeast of downtown. Des Moines police are investigating the death of a man found Saturday night in an industrial area southeast of downtown Des Moines. Patrol officers found the man's body along the roadside in the 2400 block of East Market Street just after 9 p.m. while responding to the report of a person down, according to a news release. Detectives are investigating it as a suspicious death, and witnesses are being interviewed, the release said. It did not include any details on why police considered the death suspicious. The Des Moines Crime Scene Unit was processing the scene for evidence Saturday night, police said. The body was discovered in a heavily industrial area south of the railroad tracks that run into downtown Des Moines, near Dean Lake and the Titan Tire manufacturing facility. Also in the Register, Iowa woman charged in crash that killed teen fleeing scene. A Des Moines woman has been arrested in a 2-year-old hit-and-run crash that killed a 14-year-old on a moped. The Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier reports that Fayette County Sheriff Marty Fisher said 26-year-old Kelly Jo Michael of Des Moines was arrested Friday and charged with vehicular homicide and leaving the scene of an accident in the death of Caden Estling. The teen from Maynard was struck in June 2018 while driving a moped along Iowa 150, about 2.5 miles south of Fayette. Michael is jailed on $50,000 cash-only bond. It wasn't immediately clear if she had an attorney who could speak on her behalf. In the Metro and Iowa section, Carol Hunter of the Register reports, report to show Polk's racial wealth gap. A group of Metro Des Moines black leaders will unveil a blueprint on Tuesday outlining strategies to close the racial wealth divide in Polk County. The Directors Council, a nonprofit organization made up of CEOs and executive directors of organizations in the Metro, will discuss, quote, One Economy, a Blueprint for Action, end quote, in a Zoom conference at 1 p.m. Tuesday. Business, nonprofit, and other community leaders are urged to attend. The program includes breakout groups to encourage further discussion. Pre-registration is required. Go to dsmpartnership.com/events to register. The Council's One Economy initiative focuses attention on the financial inequities between white and black residents of Polk County and seeks to shape an economy that builds opportunity for all. Tyree Caldwell-Johnson, chair of the Directors' Council, said the blueprint will set out goals and concrete actionable strategies to address persistent inequities faced by individuals of African descent. The blueprint is a follow-up to a report commissioned in 2017 by the Council, One Economy, the State of Black Polk County, which documented yawning racial gaps in education, employment, finances, business, ownership, housing, health, criminal justice, and other areas. For example, the median income for African American households in Polk County was less than half of that of the county as a whole in 2014, $26,725, compared with $59,844, the report found. And African Americans made up 65% of Des Moines' cost burden renters, defined as spending more than 30% of their income on housing. The Des Moines Register, the Greater Des Moines Partnership, and KCCI-TV are joining with the Directors' Council One Economy Initiative in presenting this event. Ian Richardson of the Register reports, Iowa Dems and U.S. House plan mobile home protections. The three Iowa Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives have proposed legislation to strengthen protections for people living in many mobile home parks around the country. Representatives Cindy Axne, Abby Finkenauer, and Dave Lobsack have introduced the Helping Owners Meet Essential Standards Act, which will require mobile home park owners who take out federally connected loans to follow certain guidelines regarding evictions and rent increases. In a news release, the Democrats said the bill is a response to the trend of private equity firms purchasing mobile home parks in Iowa and across the country, and in some cases, increasing rents dramatically. Quote, the story here in Iowa has become too well known. An outside investor buys up a mobile home park, and soon after, Iowans in these communities get runaway rent increases, coupled with poor or absent communication, Axne, who represents Iowa's 3rd District, said in the release. Quote, it's unacceptable, especially in uncertain economic times, and predatory practices like these should not be financed with federal support, end quote. Axne said several purchases in Iowa by outside investors have used federal loans. Quote, this is personal, Finkenauer, who represents Iowa's 1st District, said in the release. Quote, we've got to protect our friends and neighbors from predatory investors who treat their residents' hard-earned homes like pieces on a monopoly board, end quote. When a company purchases a mobile home park using loans supported by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the bill would require owners to follow certain guidelines that include providing residents with a renewable lease, giving advanced notice of rent increases, and giving at least 60 days notice of ownership if closing or selling the community. Residents would also be protected from so-called no-cause evictions, which are currently legal in Iowa mobile home parks. Protections for Iowa's mobile home residents have become a point of focus for Iowa's congressional delegation over the past several months. In January, Axne introduced a separate bill with U.S. Representative Ro Khanna, a Democrat from California, that would provide federal grants to local groups seeking to purchase and maintain mobile home communities. Finkenauer has called on the Federal Trade Commission to investigate reports of out-of-state investment companies buying mobile home parks and hiking rents. The introduction of that bill at the U.S. level comes after a push to add protections for mobile home renters fizzled at the state level. In February, key Republican leaders in both chambers decided not to advance a bipartisan bill that would have added protections for residents against steep rent hikes and evictions. The bill had the support of many tenant advocacy groups, but was opposed by mobile home park owners. Although some state lawmakers said they plan to keep pursuing a bill that would strike a compromise between residents and mobile home owners, no additional legislation was passed after the legislature returned from a several-week break due to the coronavirus. The new U.S. House bill has the support of multiple groups that represent mobile home park residents, including MHA Action, the National Consumer Law Center, and the National Housing Law Project, according to the release. The front page of today's Metro in Iowa section also focuses on a photo editorial of Valley High School graduates who take center stage. One picture depicts Valley High School senior Omar Mustafa speaking to the graduating class during Valley High's 2020 graduation commencement at Valley Stadium in West Des Moines on Saturday. In the picture, Mustafa is standing at a podium speaking into a microphone wearing a cap and gown with an ASL interpreter standing in front and beside, and a few unmasked administrators presumably sitting on chairs behind him. There's also a picture of the class members sitting in caps and gowns, many wearing shorts, all socially distanced. The graduates all appear to be sitting in chairs placed at least 6 feet apart. There's a picture of a Des Moines Valley High School graduate walking across the stage with her diploma in hand and her leashed service dog by her side. There's a picture of a Des Moines graduate wearing a cap and gown and a mask, moving his tassel as his graduation is announced. And a picture of a smiling graduate wearing a cap, gown, and what appear to be honor cords around his neck, with his diploma in one hand and his mask in the other hand. It appears that students, from the pictures, it appears that they approached the stage wearing their mask and then were able to take their mask off for photos and then presumably put their mask on again afterward. Today's Des Moines Register also includes a story from the Sioux City Journal written by Earl Horlick, titled Students Honored for Researching Flight 232. On July 19, 1989, United Airlines Flight 232 from Denver to Chicago crash-landed outside of Sioux City due to engine failure. Of the 296 passengers on board, 112 died in the crash, while 184 survived. The crash, the fifth deadliest involving a DC-10, has been lauded as an example of how a flight crew can handle an emergency without conventional control, as well as how a community can band together in uncertain times. More than 30 years later, the legacy of Flight 232 left a lasting impression on the survivors, as well as many Siouxland residents. This was what Alex Johnson found out when she and her fellow Bishop Heelan Catholic High School soon-to-be seniors, Anna Paskey, Izzy Gunderson, and Jacob Salmon, combed through archival material on the crash and conducted interviews. Quote, even after all that time, the memories remain fresh, Johnson told the Sioux City Journal. The research of the students, titled Flight 232, Breaking Barriers in the Community Response, was one of two presentations selected from the state of Iowa to compete in the National History Day Contest. Established in 1974, the National History Day Contest currently engages more than 500,000 students every year in conducting original research on historical topics of interest. Students present their findings in such ways as documentary, paper, or, in the case of the Heelan students, a website. During other years, students would present their original research to National History Day judges in person in College Park, Maryland. This year, due to COVID-19 concerns, the competition was a so-called virtual one. Quote, ordinarily, the judges would look at our website and ask questions afterwards, Johnson's teammate, Anna Paskey, said of the contest that was held June 14th through 20th. Quote, this year, judges had to rely solely on our website, end quote. Johnson said the team was okay with that since they had advanced through the district and the state rounds of the National History Day contest on the strength of their website. That was all due to COVID-19. Quote, we used it as an opportunity to add more research and make the website more complete, Johnson said. Specifically, the students noted that the Flight 232 emergency plan broke barriers because it allowed organizations like fire departments, hospitals, law enforcement, and the Iowa National Guard, and many others to work together. Similarly, Siouxland broke barriers because citizens came together to support survivors of the crash, as well as first responders, by providing food, clothing, and lodging. Quote, this is why Flight 232 was so memorable for so many people, Paskey said. If you worked in a hospital, you were called in to help. Even if you donated blood as a result of the crash, you knew you were helping out, end quote. That was what Johnson wanted people to take away from their presentation. Quote, when faced with an emergency, Siouxland came together as a community, she said. Indeed, Johnson said the research inspired Helan faculty members as well as her own family to share their own Flight 232 memories. Quote, it was really interesting, she said. This was stuff you wouldn't get from a history book, end quote. Paskey said her team will find out how well they did at the National History Day contest later this week. No matter how well they do, Paskey will take what she learned while applying it to future studies. Quote, I'd like to become a software engineer after college, she said. Johnson wants to have a career in international business. Quote, everyone can break barriers while coming together, she said. That's what makes us stronger, end quote. In national news, Emily Wagster Pettis of the Associated Press reports in today's Register, Mississippi flag symbol may soon be erased. Spectators at the Mississippi Capitol broke into applause Saturday as lawmakers took a step toward erasing the Confederate battle emblem from the state flag, a symbol that has come under intensifying criticism in recent weeks amid nationwide protests against racial injustice. Quote, the eyes of the state, the nation, and indeed the world are on this house, the second-ranking office in the Mississippi House, Jason White, told his colleagues. The House and Senate voted by more than the required two-thirds majority to suspend legislative deadlines and file a bill to change the flag. That would allow debate on a bill as soon as Sunday. Saturday's vote was the big test because of the margin. Only a simple majority is needed to pass a bill. Republican Governor Tate Reeves said Saturday for the first time that he would sign a bill to change the flag if the Republican-controlled legislature sends him one. He had previously said that he would not veto one, a more passive stance. A bill will say that the current flag will be removed from state law. A commission would design a new flag that cannot include the Confederate battle emblem, but must include the phrase, In God We Trust. In the Nation and World Watch, published in today's Register, Southwest Virginia man charged in connection with cross burning. A man was arrested Friday in connection with the burning of a cross on the front lawn of a black teenager who had organized a civil rights protest the previous day. James Brown, aged 40, of Marion, Virginia, was charged with lying to federal agents and criminal interference with fair housing based on the victim's race. According to an affidavit filed by an FBI special agent, a black woman flagged down a police officer who was responding to a report of a possible gunshot and told him someone had put a burning cross in her yard. In New York, Occupy City Hall protest urges budget cuts for New York City police. Hundreds of protesters camped outside City Hall demanded that lawmakers slash the New York City police budget. The encampment in City Hall Park is part of a national so-called defund the police movement seeking more spending on other needs like housing and education. It emerged after the deaths of George Floyd and other black Americans killed by law enforcement. Demonstrators demand that the city council cut at least $1 billion from the $6 billion police budget when it begins work on a new city budget. And I Love New York logo designer and magazine co-founder Glazer dies. Milton Glaser, the groundbreaking graphic designer who adorned Bob Dylan's silhouette with psychedelic hair and summed up the feelings for his native New York with, quote, "I heart New York," end quote, died Friday on his 91st birthday. The cause was a stroke, and Glaser had also had renal failure, his wife Shirley Glaser told the New York Times. In posters, logos, advertisements, and book covers, Glaser was the designer on the team that founded New York Magazine with Clay Felker in the late 1960s. Ireland's Michael Martin to lead historic government coalition. Centrist politician Michael Martin became Ireland's prime minister Saturday, fusing two longtime rival parties into a coalition 4 months after an election that upended the status quo. The deal will see Martin's Fianna Fáil govern with Fine Gael, the party of the outgoing leader Leo Varadkar, and with the smaller Green Party. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, bitter opponents whose roots lie in opposing sides of the civil war that followed Ireland's independence from the United Kingdom, had never previously governed together. And returning to local news, Travis Hines of the Ames Tribune reports in the Gazette, Black Lives Matter demonstrators face off with police, protest ends peacefully. A standoff between Black police and Black Lives Matter marchers ended without incident Saturday after the two parties negotiated a peaceful end to the demonstration at Papa John's Sculpture Park. The denouement of tensions came just days after police arrested about 20 near the Iowa Capitol on Monday, using what protesters said were aggressive use of pepper spray, pushing protesters, and using the kettling technique, a controversial tactic that surrounds demonstrators before making arrests. Police in riot gear and protesters stood face-to-face for nearly an hour after the march was pushed down from Ingersoll Avenue along the 15th Street to Grand Avenue. During that time, protesters detailed their demands, including an investigation into Monday's arrests, an executive order from Governor Kim Reynolds that would allow those with felony convictions to vote, the decriminalization of marijuana, and an end to the school resource officer program. Eventually, police and a number of the group's leaders negotiated an end to the demonstration, with police agreeing to leave the area if the protesters would remain in the sculpture park and not block traffic. The march began in the sculpture park and moved east down Locust Street, stopping traffic in front of Des Moines restaurants and drawing curious looks from diners and drivers as the protesters chanted. The group then went north to Grand Avenue and up 15th to Ingersoll Avenue, where police in riot gear stopped them from advancing west or going east into downtown. The group went back down 15th Street and off the street at the corner of the sculpture park. Police stood in the intersection facing the group, which danced and listed its demands. There was no evidence of violence or destruction of property. By the time the end was negotiated, which included Representative Ako Abdul-Samad and Reverend Rob Johnson as intermediaries, fewer than 50 protesters remained. Those that were still there dispersed peacefully into the sculpture park, where organizer Matthew Bruce encouraged them to attend an event Sunday in the East Village in support of the Black LGBTQ community and a demonstration Monday at the Iowa Capitol. And that does it for the first hour of the Register on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print disabled. Up next, we'll give a shout-out to all our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. Thank you for listening.